Today's episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you by Feels. Sponsors like Feels help keep the lights on here at Blotter HQ, so check those show notes for a link you can use and a promo code, and keep an ear out for that later in the episode. And that episode starts right now.
Looking back on things now, I should have seen what was coming. But I had never loved like that before. I saw what I wanted to see.
Elizabeth Rome is headlining one of Lifetime's Ripped from the Headlines true crime offerings this month, Ann Rule's Sleeping with Danger. Is the Blonde Lady in Peril tale based on the real crimes of the cretinous John Brandon essential, or is it just the same old, same old? Headlining our discussion is Kevin Flynn of, among other podcasts, the Law & Order All-Franchise Review Pod, These Are Their Stories. Later, I'll be talking to Jessica Lees about The Last Narc, why it's back, whether it was worth the wait, and watching Narcos Mexico before or afterwards. Wherever we come out on recommending these properties, I am fairly certain it is not because I'm a lesbian. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 153. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast where we try to figure out which true crime is worth your time. I am so excited that Kevin Flynn is joining me for this segment. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Sarah. I'm so pleased that you asked me, finally.
I mean, who else would I ask for this Law & Order-tastic offering from Lifetime?
It just happened that way.
It really is serendipitous. But for whom? Let's find out. Here comes the Most Wanted section, part one, in today's episode. We are talking about, as I said, Ann Rule's Sleeping with Danger, which I keep calling variously Ann Rule, May I Sleep with Danger?
Mother, may I
sleep with Ann Rule? Oh, yeah, it's not good. Let me run down the case file quickly from Lifetime's press page before we start talking about the actual movie. Quote, Sleeping with Danger is inspired by Ann Rule's true crime collection, Mortal Danger and Other True Cases. Paul Carter, Antonio Cupo, was like a knight in shining armor when he first met flight attendant Grace Tanner, Elizabeth Rome, and swept her into a passionate love affair. But her dream man quickly became her nightmare as his jealous rage ultimately led to a brutal attack. Incredibly, Grace was able to escape and go into hiding. Fearing for her life and the safety of other women Paul might seduce, Grace works with the police to bring Paul to justice. End quote. Like I said, this is based on the real case of John Brandon, a coercive control identity shifter in the Pacific Northwest. We'll have a link in the show notes. I will drop a content warning here for an implied sexual assault as well as not implied domestic violence and a fairly startling and graphic murder-suicide at the end. Spoiler. Okay, this isn't good, but it isn't quite bad either. I'm not sure where that left you, Kevin, in terms of your overall thoughts on whether this was entertaining. What'd you think?
You hit it sort of right as I was thinking about it, like not a thumbs up and not a thumbs down, but an absolute thumb sideways.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of it is, I mean, because it's a real story, you want to be sympathetic to everybody involved.
Yes.
But part of this is somewhat run of the mill, if that can even be used to describe these kinds of crimes. We've seen stories like this before. And while it has some really interesting details and, you know, some things that do set it apart, the fact that even Ann Rule didn't commit 80,000 words to this particular story, that it got lumped in with some smaller stuff, kind of goes to, unfortunately, the more common nature of these kinds of domestic dramas. Now, you know, most of the time it doesn't end up in death, or even worse, a Lifetime movie. But I did think that, you know, a lot of this was sort of, I've seen this before. When is this going to get different?
Yeah. And as you were saying, I think that says as much about Lifetime and it says as much about these crimes and the frequency of these crimes, really, as it says about Lifetime's tendency to gravitate towards stories like this, where it's like, I guess it's sort of a happy ending in that our hero does not die, but it's quite dark on the way to that. Lives are lost, and it's also, you know, there isn't anything new about the way this is told that means that I would necessarily recommend that someone seek it out who's, you know, hotel TV only had three other channels. I mean, I'm just not sure what circumstances I would recommend this. You asked for a clip from fairly early on in the film. Would you like to talk about why you asked for this nugget, or shall we hear it first?
Let's hear it first.
Okay.
I don't know, Jerry. At 38, what the hell am I doing with my life, really?
Okay, she's more like 50 and not 38. So right away, you know, the willing suspension of disbelief is pushed back a bit.
Yeah.
But this scene here where she's with her friend in the bar, like if this were a musical, this would be her I Want song where, you know, someday my prince will come, or if I were a rich man. What, you know, it would be, oh, what am I doing with my life?
Yes.
Oh, I'm just waiting for the wrong thing to come along so I can get swept up in it. And it seemed very performative to me that, again, we have the one friend who I'm sure is the composite of everybody in her life.
Yes.
And so this part of it was very clunky for me, I thought. So first of all, just the idea that says, I'm 38. I'm much older myself, but you know,
you also haven't had so much work done that you're in the uncanny valley. That's, I assume.
No, I haven't had. I'm getting some work done, but I haven't had anything that's going to make me look good. Yeah, it's the second most favorite thing that I've ever heard her say. You know, right next to.
Is this because I'm a lesbian?
Oh my god.
Oh, that's my ringtone.
the follow on good really makes it art. I mean, leaving aside the I think Elizabeth Rome has not had a ton to do of late. The last time I saw her in anything was an episode of Celebrity Ghost Stories. I don't wish to discuss it.
I remember seeing her in Joy with Jennifer Lawrence.
Okay.
The one about the self ringing mop, right? it was one of those.
Bradley Cooper's in it too, but
they're not dancing. Okay. Anyhow, yeah.
I mean, I am very sympathetic to the reasons that lady actors get this kind of work done, because they feel like they're not going to work unless they can look, I mean, both 35, but then in the way they look 35, you suspect they're 55. She's almost exactly my age. She's a month younger than me. She's 47. But she looks so taut and shiny and alas, dainty that it's...
You're great with words.
It is
disconcerting. You're like Ogden Nash. You just make up things that just sound like they're completely right and have been that way forever.
Well, but she does look alas, dainty, right?
Alas, dainty, yeah. Exactly.
But you're so right about that this really would be... There would be sort of like the opening number in the musical, and then she and the composite friend, because this is a satellite system of cable stations that can't necessarily afford. And like, this friend is already Canadian, so like, how much money did they pay Elizabeth Rome? And then, if my math is correct, which it often is not, this is supposed to be taking place in 1989, but zero effort has been made in the production design, except that people do not have smartphones and that the answering machine is being used occasionally as a plot linchpin. no effort has been made to place you in any particular time, presumably because they couldn't afford that either.
Right. So, which makes it very different than something like the Betty Broderick stuff, the Dirty John season 2.
Yes.
Which takes place in the 80s. And, you know, for a couple that came of age in the 60s, they had the Brodericks very Falcon Crest / Miami Vice / Cyndi Lauper infused. So you remember, oh, it's 1984. Okay, I got
sure.
It. And there isn't any of that. Now, that's fine because sometimes it gets, you know, a little overboard and it's like, hey, look at somebody's playing ColecoVision, which came out that year, you know, and it ends up being like a checklist of, you know, it's like a Billy Joel song about history. It's let's make sure we have all these things in there. but you're right. It didn't even do anything really to sort of place it into a certain time because it isn't. It was sort of when it came to the point where I realized she didn't have a cell phone that I recalled, oh, this is taking place, you know, before the turn of the century.
Right.
And is that an important, I mean, it's kind of an important thing in the sense that for us today, that we would think that there were certain resources, there were certain attitudes about domestic violence and general knowledge about it and things like that, that would explain why X, Y, and Z was not happening. And I think maybe just a little more of placing it, you know, in that time without being so heavy handed, you know, that everybody's, you know, got the latest fashion. Just, you're right, if they just could kind of ring a bell that lets people know what time frame it's set in.
Well, that's so interesting that you bring that up, because I was about to say, why not just have it in the present day and just tweak it so that the way in which Paul is controlling her is up to date with technology.
Mm-hmm.
But you make such a good point that I think part of the point of this story is that it did take place in the late 80s, early 90s, where attitudes were different, resources were different. And I think actually, if we're talking about the original Dirty John, there's a big aspect of that story where it's like, you know, why weren't certain things coming up when she Googled him? Like, how hard was she actually Googling him? To be clear, I'm not victim blaming Dirty John ladies or Grace. So, you know, that's
talking plot points. It's plot points, Aaron. It's fine.
But that's sort of that's an issue that it's like for a movie that makes such a point of trying to bring Grace into like the cone of understanding of what's happening to her, that there isn't also like just make it explicit that this isn't a time where even if law enforcement or her resources were tempted to victim blame and be like, well, why didn't you Google this guy and find out that he had a Peeping Tom conviction? She couldn't. There was no
right.
There wasn't right. Google.
And I think if you took it out of 1994, or that 5-year period there from 89 to 94, and placed it in today, you know, the way that Paul would attempt to control her would be vastly different. He would be using her cell phone to monitor her, to track her, to do other sorts of things. It would be very hard for her to just sort of vanish for a week without somebody like that. It sort of changes the nature of the story. And if they're going to go for, you know, rip from the headlines, and they're going to try to keep it close to, you know, it depends if it's Anne Rule or Lee Child, right? If it's Anne Rule, you expect it to be, oh, it's a real story. So right. I think, you know, they want to tack as close to the spine of the original tale as possible. It makes metaphors. But it is interesting, you know, there's a whole long cocktail party discussion about writing stories that take place after, say, 2007, when the iPhone comes out, and there's no more novelty or mystery anywhere in the world. You can there's no more arguments in a bar over what was the name of the starting catcher for the Mets in 1978, because boom, you can just get that, right?
Right.
And you know, there's so many times when my wife and I are sitting on the couch and we say, "Oh, what do we know that person from?" And 30 seconds later, we, you know, we've got our phone open at IMDb and boom, oh, well, wait, oh, he was in that other thing. Oh, yeah, right, 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 right. So the idea that, you know, it's almost nostalgic for the idea that, you know, without the cell phone, Mulder didn't know where Scully was, right? And you put that a little earlier and it's, you know, one of the Hardy Boys has no idea where the other Hardy Boy is because they don't have a cell phone.
Yeah.
But the way the story gets told and the mystery and that was one of the great things about Stranger Things being in the 80s is that it was a way to separate those characters from the rest of the world. They didn't have the technology. They were cut off. Very much like in Dracula, our core group. It's like, it's us against the world. No one believes us. And so to bring this all back on this crazy tangent that I'm going on, I think I had some coffee right before we started to record. I think it just sort of changes the nature of how you would show an abusive relationship today versus just a generation ago.
Yeah, I agree. And yet there's also, well, you know, there's two questions here. There's like, when do you set this? Like, when are we? And how are you going to structure it? And then there's the, like, when are we in the story pacing of it, which I want to get to in a second. But first, I'd like to play a clip of her. They're moving into their country home that they bought together, Grace and Paul. Yeah. And she discovers his cache of, like, dirty deeds, legal files, and questions him on it. And I had some notes, and I'm wondering if you had similar notes. Here's clip three.
Legal papers, lawsuits. You were accused of being a peeping Tom.
So I used to live next door to this crazy woman who thought everyone was spying on her. But no, my love, I am not, or was not, a peeping Tom.
And this one says that a patient sued you for sexual battery and medical malpractice. That's a pretty big deal.
Sweetheart, why didn't anyone you tell me can about sue that? Anyone.
No, not everybody has as many lawsuits.
Well, I think you need to talk to more doctors because, yes, they do. People try to get money out of us. But all of that has been dealt with a long time ago.
This one is actually more recent. This isn't a long time ago. So is this why you gave your business to Natasha?
Unless I wanted everything I had worked for to go in the trash, then yeah, of course I had to put it in her name. But it's been dealt with. It's just legal BS.
I'm asking
I had to deal-
you why you didn't tell me the truth. You said to me that you gave your business up because you wanted to reach more people and make a bigger impact.
Yeah. What are we doing? We are making a bigger impact and we're reaching more people. You should be thanking me for Christ's sake.
What is this? What about this?
Just give it to me, please.
No, this one.
You know what? We're done with this. We're done with this.
And then the slap across the face. Yeah.
Yeah. Not sure that using the word impact versus difference was the direction in this particular scene when he backhands her across the face. The more recent was just a very Serena Sutherland, Elizabeth Rome struggling to get through a whole page of legalese dialogue that it really brought me back. Not necessarily in a good way, but I've sort of grown fond of that performance in a way over the years, the same way you know, love that cousin of yours who you're pretty sure you saw eating paint chips back in the 70s.
Is this because I'm a lesbian?
No. Good. Good. That's amazing. It's, first of all, they have to have her discover it this way, but second of all, like, it's not that it's not believable that this woman is continuing to come across evidence that something is hinky, as they would say in The Fugitive, but this is about a third of the way through. And from here, I do think that in this scene, he and his BS artistry are well written and, like, on point for what this would be. But from here to like 15 minutes from the end, I would say that the build to the violent climax sort of slows way down. And then we kind of rush through a lot of plot at the end. And then there's an extended break in the middle where Emmy Rogers is trying to explain to Grace that she's victim blaming herself. How did you feel about the pacing of it? Did you think that it was too didactic in the middle, at least for viewers like us who sit with this kind of material all the time?
Well, I liked your point about how they developed Paul's personality. Flaws.
Disordered personality, like, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that he starts off with the love bombing, and I thought that they actually did an okay job of sort of, you know, she is the frog in the pot as they're turning the heat up,
mm-hmm.
You know, with a lot of bad behavior and then a grand gesture. And her inability to understand and come to terms with it, I thought was very real.
Yeah.
So when she goes to the shelter for the first time, it's like, oh, he hardly ever does anything. But, you know, he's the excuses that she makes for him. I thought that whole thing sort of played out very well. I could see a little bit more of, like, why she wanted to stay. Felt like she needed to stay in the relationship. If it was just sort of a very simple, this is my guy, and I, you know, I think this is the way it's supposed to be, or if it's more of, well, like, you know, financially I'm attached to him, or whatever it is.
Sunk costs theory or fallacy. Yeah, right. Yes, exactly.
But right as soon as, you know, we get to I'm going on the, here's your smoothie. That's what it was. Lie down and I'll take care of you, and your car has a knock and I'll take care of that. Once we get to that point, it really does sort of take off, and it's very fast. And like you say, once that gets resolved, there is just this weird downshift in speed and tone, that seems like, you know, you've already had the climax of the story. Which is, you know, the question is something bad going to happen? Is she going to get away? And she does. And then so far, all this, you know, like, falling action at the end, I think I could have seen that maybe a little less of that.
Yeah. And then there's a Silence of the Lambs style door knock fake out. But first, I'd like to play a clip from her trip to the shelter, her stay at the shelter, where she's definitely rationalizing his behavior. And your friend and mine, Emmy Rogers, is trying to explain to her, like, you know, do you hear yourself? I think this is, given that this is supposed to be in, whatever, 91 or something like that, that this is maybe not, that this is perhaps anachronistic, but it's always nice to see Ms. Leslie Hendricks getting some paper. Here's clip four.
Right now, he's learning what life is like without me, and I know he loves
me. Oh. Let's try clip four again.
Right now, he's learning what life is like without me, and I know he loves me. He's not going to want to lose me. This will blow over. It always does.
Grace, when you say things like it always does, you understand that you're implying multiple chances.
Well, yeah, a few, but he's never pulled a gun on me before, ever.
Grace, being a victim of abuse is nothing to be ashamed of. It's not your fault.
I know that it's not my fault. Paul loses his temper sometimes, and we talk about it all the time. And this particular incident happened because I had rejected something very, very nice that he was doing for me.
Grace, look at me. You need to hear your own words. He got violent because of your rejection. Now, isn't that you saying that it is your fault?
You know what? I'm sorry. That was definitely a poor choice of words.
This is a little PSA-ish, but I think it's pretty well acted by both of them.
The more you know.
Yeah. Yes, Rainbow and Star. Yeah, I mean, I think the scene works. But once again, we're back to one of the conflicts with this property, which is that it hasn't settled on when it is. So parts mm-hmm. of it that should be more compelling are not, because they don't exactly read for the time when they're supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, it may be that, you know, at this moment in history, in popular culture, you know, early 90s, that maybe that women of abuse do not have the resources or the knowledge or whatever, so that they have to have, you know, remedial domestic violence, you know, 101. But the audience today does.
Right.
So while it's in service of the character, it's really not in service of the audience. So, sometimes you get a program like, say, Masters of Sex, and the whole thing is that they are exploring, you know, they're pioneers in exploring sexuality. And all the things that they learn are things that we already know today, right, about the way bodies work and stimulation and whatever. And the stories about them discovering that, the audience already has more knowledge than the characters.
Right.
And so part of that is the journey of watching them discover. But if you already know more than the characters going into something like this, then instead of watching them discover, you're waiting for them to catch up with you. And I think that's, I don't know if I explained that very well, but I liked how I said it.
No, I think you're right on. But I think the question here is there a way, because in Masters of Sex, I think they did a good job sort of making the character's journey compelling enough on its own that it didn't matter that it was already like road that you had driven down before. So that was poorly metaphorized, but let's continue. That here, I think because they are trying to neighborhood play when it is, then they're not able to, I mean, at least they're not sort of cheating it or like winking at the audience, like, well, you already know this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also in this, like, it's right on the edge of like collapsing onto the camp side of the line, like old school Lifetime V.C. Andrews-ish plotting for most of the film. And when you get into the murder smoothies, then I think it blunders across the line. I actually have a clip of this where she's like, wow, I feel really sick. And he's like, why don't you, you know, go lie down and I'm going to make you another one of my delicious, healthful shakes. And then he grows a mustache and twirls it. And then he goes into the kitchen and the sound effects, like the Emmy for scoring a poisoned green drink, goes to this production. Here's clip 5.
Why don't you get back to bed? I'll make you another shake. I'll get some nutrients in you.
I mean, don't they sell that stuff, the two of them?
Yeah.
You know, powders and pills and garbage that you're, you know, supposed to be good for you. Why would she not? I don't know. I know why not, because it's a fake story. Okay, never mind.
Well, I mean, why does he store the rat poison with the skull and crossbones on all six sides of the package right behind the sesame crackers?
You know, yes, I mean, for convenience, but, you know, he's such a diabolical genius in every way, except, how did that get there? I thought it was the Cheerios.
Yeah. I mean, I guess from the sometimes they catch themselves file, I'm glad that she figured that out with some dispatch, but then
he was like in The Sixth Sense where they show that video and the mom brings the tray of the girl's soup and brings the poison with her.
Yeah.
And decides to put it in the right in front of, you know, do that in the kitchen. Don't bring the poison to the girl's bedroom and do it right there. You know, it's a little too convenient.
Yeah, it is.
Get a second camera. Do a different angle. You know, you keep the poison down below the sink.
Yeah, where she would never look. And what I wonder what she thought she was looking for. Also.
Poison, obviously.
Or raisins. Just like, I'm completely nauseated. He's probably putting raisins in here. Gold ones. Oh. I shouldn't be too hard on it. I think the original or the sort of foundational problem with Mother May I Sleep With Serena Sutherland is what we said right up top, which is that it's not terrible, but because it's not terrible, it's just not very entertaining. I think it's rather better done than you might expect, given this lead actor. But it's just not quite there. Kupo's good, though. I like that guy.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think he played Charming well enough that when he throws the table over, that it's enough of a contrast.
Mm-hmm.
If he were too creepy up front or looked, you know, a little mean, right? That contrast doesn't come through. So he was a good pick for this part.
Yep, agree. And they wrote it skillfully or adapted it skillfully. Anne Rule was a godmother of the genre in many ways, but elegant prose, perhaps not her hallmark, as it were. This was rather elegantly written to make his kind of creepy or perhaps not neurotypical behavior seem more like goofy bumbling in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes clear that he is a cretin. So,
yeah,
I thought that was well done. But I also think, listeners, that you have better things to do with an hour and 27 minutes unless you really miss Serena, which I'll try not to judge you.
But also, don't forget, you know, your girl, Leslie Hendricks.
Oh, yes. The last time I actually saw her before this was voting for president in 2016.
It's a great story. Why don't you tell it?
Well, it makes me a little sad, actually. But here it is once again, in case you haven't listened to recent episodes of these are their stories, which what are you doing with your lives? But when I voted for president in 2016, I really thought I was in the endless line at this high school gym next to Leslie Hendricks, who plays Emmy Rogers. I tried to be cool and like snap a picture with my phone and then check it for myself. This failed. Once we got spaced out a little more at the actual booths, it became clear that it was her. Everybody voted. We all kind of shuffle out together in that same voting group. And then she turns to the sidewalk at large and announces, "I just voted for the first woman president of the United States." And she raised her arms in victory. And then she headed home and was vaping. And the rest is, as they say, history still in process.
Yeah. Her last shining moment.
I know. Do you have anything else to add to wrap up this discussion? Do you feel like people should make time for this one or no?
No, I mean that there's a lot of good. There's much better things out there, you know, to watch. You know, Lifetime is basic cable for a reason. You know, this is a very basic story here. Yeah. Very basic television movie. It's, you know, maybe it'll win an Emmy for the music, but it's not going to win an Emmy for a screenplay or directing or acting or anything like that.
No.
It's fine. If it's on, it's not objectionable. You can watch if it's that and Duck Dynasty. Well, then by all means, come over to this crime piece. But, you know, if there are enough podcasts to point you to other things that you could be watching.
Absolutely. I also regret to inform the listenership that Lifetime Movies' budget is not set to improve, because this is in the same family of channels as A&E or A plus E Inc., which, thanks to the loss of Live PD, has lost fully half of its month-to-month revenue. So the next version of this is going to be like, I don't even know, Danny Terrio and a bunch of Italians with their voices dubbed.
Well, I think we were waiting for like the best Zoom crime that was ever committed so we can immediately adapt that.
Oh, God, yeah. Did you watch that basically like Skype murder movie with, I think, John Cho?
No. Was there one?
Yeah, it was from a couple of years ago before, you know, waves hands, all of this. It was not good exactly, but I wasn't looking at my phone for most of it. So, yeah.
Well, that's a good indicator.
Exactly.
Put the phone down, and by the time I went to reach for it again, I forgot where I put it.
And everyone was dead.
Everyone was dead.
All right. Speaking of people reaching for their phones to check their podcast app.
In local news today, bees.
Bees.
Kevin, besides these are their stories, where else can listeners find you?
Well, I have a big podcast that I sit on, and it's called Crime Writers On.
I've heard of it.
We do a lot of the same thing, and yet we're still friends and not enemies.
Yeah.
And then he twirls his mustache. But you also can watch our podcast on Facebook Watch. There is a video version that we just started, and I spend many hours trying to make Laura Brooker not look blue.
Oh, no.
And Toby Ball look pink. You know, so it's... So I'm still learning, but we're very busy over here in Studio C at Partners in Crime Media.
That is fantastic. Thank you so much for making the time, and congrats on the new video cast. What are we supposed to call those now?
I'm calling it TV shows, but you can't. It's not on TV.
Crime Writers On .. TV.
Video. I just say it's on Facebook Watch. It's on. It's a Facebook Watch show, and people are like, Facebook Watch? You mean like Apple Watch? Like, no, it's not a watch. You watch it. It's on your app, Mom. I'm trying to explain this to my mother.
I actually also make that mistake, like, mentally. Then I'm like, oh, Facebook has a watch now? Jesus, we're all doomed. Before we move on to our second guest and second most wanted section, a quick word from our sponsor, Feels. It's 2020, so a question during an ad spot about whether you're experiencing stress, anxiety, or trouble sleeping is probably strictly rhetorical. But whether you're struggling with one of those, more than one, or all three with a side of chronic pain, Feels, with an A, is a better way to feel better. Feels' premium CBD keeps your head clear and helps you feel your best. CBD has been proven to reduce anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness, and Feels has helped me do less staring at the ceiling, less worrying about worrying, and more focusing and getting things done. The world of CBD might seem a little intimidating if you're new to it, but Feels helps you do less worrying about that, too. Feels offers a CBD hotline featuring real human support. Where to start and how to find the best dosage for you, because everyone's different. But one thing about Feels is the same for everyone. It's a cinch to take. Just place a few drops under your tongue and you'll feel the difference in minutes. That's it. No prep or anything. Feels works naturally and you won't feel any high or hangover and you won't get addicted. Feels' hassle-free membership is a cinch as well. Feels is shipped direct to your doorstep every month. Members save money on every order and you can pause or cancel anytime you like. Feels has me feeling my best every day and it can help you too. Become a member today and get 50% off your first order with free shipping. Head to feels.com/blotter. That's feals.com/blotter, BLOTTER, to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order and free shipping. feals.com/blotter. Thanks, Feels. Yes, that's right. It's a second most wanted section of the episode, even though The Last Narc, which is what we're talking about as a series prospect, was about to turn into something of a cold case earlier in the summer. But it's back. I had planned to discuss it with Jessica Lees, and now I can. Welcome back.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me on. This is a long-awaited project of ours.
It is. I hope that it lived up to some expectations. In case everyone forgot what this is even about, because it seemed like you and I were, for a while, the only ones who even cared that Amazon disappeared it without fanfare. Here is the case file from the Amazon landing page. Quote, in 1985, American DEA agent Enrique Kiki Camarena was kidnapped, tortured, and murdered by Mexico's most notorious drug lords. 35 years later, three former cartel insiders share unprecedented details. This is the story of Camarena, the drug cartel he infiltrated, and the narc who risked everything to discover the truth. End quote. I mean, yes and no. We'll get into some specifics in a bit, but generally, I think you and I agreed that this wasn't quite enough the story of Camarena, at least initially. And in my view, it's much more about Hector Bareilles, because he's he has all the juicy stories, and he is the one who has sort of positioned himself as this, speaking truth to power. And also doesn't have to be captioned. So generally, how do you feel?
Yeah, I think it's a huge story. And I think it's kind of disingenuous to say it's just about Camarena. But I guess that's kind of the entry point, given that this was also the subject of the Netflix series Narcos Mexico.
Yeah.
Which I have not seen in its entirety, but I kept looking back to see, okay, this was the guy that was played by this guy, and this was Diego Luna, and that kind of helped to frame it a little bit. So I see why that was kind of the point of entry in the inciting incident. But for all of that, the pacing of this ends up feeling very off. Like, there are pieces of information that you start to wonder in the first episode that you don't find out until the fourth episode. And I think there may have been a better way to organize everything that they tell us.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you do have some very good, juicy storytellers with the guys selected. Amazon does not, like, the thing isn't automatically captioned. You have to turn the captions on, which, I have just enough Spanish lingering from high school to know when captions are not entirely correct, but I can't do without them. So that's an interesting choice. But I think maybe their best storyteller is in Spanish. But they rely heavily on Bareilles because he is more closer to bilingual and can sort of switch back and forth between English and Spanish while he's telling the stories. And, you know, this is their primary source. This is the law enforcement good guy, so to say. I understand why he has such a big role in this narrative. And let me play a clip of him telling just one story from his extensive cache. But then we can talk about another choice that we might agree they should have made instead. So here's clip one.
So they grab him, start tearing his shirt off and take his pants off. Stand there naked, and his friend's watching this. So they bring this cattle prod that's got 18 batteries on it. He says, "This is your lawyer. Bend him over." So then they start giving him electrical shocks. You can see the sparks fly off of his testicles. "Tell the comandante that I'm ready to talk. Tell him I don't want to talk to him. Tell him to sit down and shut up. Now, his friend, are you going to tell me now where you stole the plane and everything, or you want a lawyer too?" He says, "No, sir, I'm fine. I don't need a lawyer."
I mean, this is a sort of flavorfully told story. He's a raconteur for sure, Bareilles. But he has a way of taking over this narrative. And I think we both agree that Jorge Godoy is this amazing figure that we would like to just see the whole story told from his perspective.
Yeah. In doing a little research around this, now that someone is finally writing articles about it, which they weren't when this was supposed to drop, I read this article, which I'm sure you'll link up in the show notes.
For sure.
On Collider.com, they interviewed the director, and he said that he says that basically he asked him one question and he talked for 2 hours. And that really does not surprise you. Like, the second you see him, he's just kind of radiating this intensity. And he tells the story like it's riddled with profanity, but he really tells it in this passionate, magnetic way. And every time he's on screen, I'm just like, okay, good, that guy again.
Yeah.
And he has this very, he's very complicated and haunted. And he is in actually quite literally haunted. The very last time you see him, he's like brushing dark spirits off of him, which was a really interesting choice to show. But he is just, he's got a way of spinning a yarn. And even I don't speak a terrible amount of Spanish. I learned a lot of new words from this documentary, but just listening to him was kind of the secret sauce that held this whole thing together. And that's not to disparage Boreas's ability to tell a story, because he does do a great job, I think, of bringing us into it and being our guy that brings us into the story. But he also does sort of make it all about him most of the time.
Yeah, he does. And Godoy, the first time we see him, I got a screen grab of this, and you will see it in the visual aids, which you can find on Twitter at Blotter Presents. He is doing this sort of shamanistic eye rolling that I was like, oh dear. Like, I don't think this man is very well. But the scene that you referred to at the end, where he's gesturing to spirits as though, you know, obviously they're right here. See, I thought was wonderful. What did you think of the direction overall? Because this director, Tiller Russell, also directed The 7-5, which I've heard great things about, although I haven't seen it yet. And Bernie, starring Jack Black, which is A, the only time I really ever liked Jack Black, and B, based on an outstanding Texas Monthly article. Link that in the show notes. But he gets a couple of shots. Like, there's this one reenactment where the Boreas reenactor is getting out of his car in a dark parking lot, and all you can see is the top of his cowboy hat in this God's eye shot, traveling through this long shadow, and then the shadow of himself getting larger as he comes out of the shadow of the truck. That will also be on Twitter. It was this shot, I just had to pause it, and I was like, the composition of this is amazing. But then at the same time, Russell sometimes really dicks around with like the slow-mo of these guys walking through hallways of abandoned houses. There's a lot of drone shots of border access roads. Like, this, I think a lot could have been solved by, not necessarily by putting Godoy in charge, because that's just a completely different, like, Terrence Malick property, but by just shortening this up and not doing so many of the things that are like on the prestige true crime bingo card. Did you feel that it was a little over directed?
I did. And I also noticed this in the choice he made to put different people in different locations while he's interviewing them. And I found that extremely distracting as well. Like, he's got Boreas sitting in this bar and it's like he's having a drink with you. And I thought that was a little precious.
Yeah.
And then you have Camarena's widow is sitting in a church. And then they have the one federal agent who's sitting in a jail. And I thought that was especially weird, because they don't ever mention that he's in jail, or whose jail is this, or is he just like, he doesn't work in a jail. He's just there with like a bunch of cells lining each side of the shot.
Meanwhile,
that was very odd.
Amazon
well.
X-Ray has like paragraphs and paragraphs about every song you're hearing, every location. Like, I think the director made sure to include all of the production notes, which like, that's fine, but I don't know. Like, we shouldn't have to pause and read up on whatever church we're in. Like, I appreciate the research, but this is an extremely complicated case, and you don't even get down to the meat of it until episode, like the very end of episode 3, beginning of episode 4, where it's like, okay, finally, Chekhov's Kiki goes off, and I don't know.
Yeah, it was, I think it was kind of one of those things. And now I'm sure we're going to talk a little bit more about this later, but when this was originally supposed to drop and didn't drop, we saw one like kind of breathless article insisting that the CIA had asked to make changes. And then we find another interview where the director just says, nah, we just hadn't finished it. And that really lends credence to the theory that he just hadn't finished it because he got so caught up in every little tiny detail, which I don't mind the X-ray extras.
Oh, I don't
because
either.
I don't think you necessarily have to see them. It's like kind of like an in-depth interactive experience. Like we're looking at the DVD extras while we're watching the thing, but it's also the end sort of hints at something even huger and then just sort of glosses over all of it and wraps it up. And I think I would have liked to know a lot more about, not necessarily, I don't necessarily need another deep dive into Iran-Contra, but I think I would have liked to have a little bit more of that shaping the story as we went along.
Yeah. And I feel like I've been watching a lot of documentaries lately about various criminal organizations in which, like contemporary footage of Ronald Reagan is used to indict him. The Roy Cohn documentary comes to mind. Fear City mm-hmm. comes to mind. And then here's President Reagan calling Mrs. Camarena in clip 2.
Hello, Camarena?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to call you to know that I you're in our prayers. You have our deepest sympathy. Your husband died for each country, every single word.
Yes.
And we'll remember your husband for his love and his dedication to this country.
Thank you, sir.
But I just want you to know also, I'm determined that we're going to pursue this drug thing and the kind of monsters that can perpetrate this kind of crime.
Monsters like your vice president, perhaps? I mean, but this is the thing. Like, I'm fine with throwing Reagan under the bus for all sorts of things, including in this clip, very obviously reading off of note cards that some assistant did not put in the correct order for him. But, like, this is in episode 2. This is the beginning of episode 2. And I kind of feel like they, you know, they had all this material from Boreas and all this context, which I don't think was unimportant, but this needed to be either shorter to get to the meat of the accusation first, or it needed to be longer and just be like, this is the, I don't know, Kiki made in Mexico, like, you know, paralleling OJ made in America, that it's like, this is like all the context of all of this. And here was what led to this point, and here is what led away, and here's what you don't know about Iran-Contra. But as far as the director being like, oh yeah, we just weren't done yet. Like, I can see that certain elisions happened because he knew that he had Amazon's X-ray to fall back on in case something got cut and wasn't clear, but also that, like, Boreas would, like, it's in Boreas's brand's best interest to be like, oh, they wanted to silence us. Like, do you ever get the feeling that over at the CIA, they're like, fucking Boreas?
All the time.
Yeah. Like, we weren't trying to silence you because you were going to blow up a huge scandal. We just want you to shut the hell up. Why can't it be both?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
You also mentioned in our rundown syllabus document that there's a little bit of confusing voiceover, like there's a confusing voiceover issue happening. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, at the top of every episode, they kind of lead you into the episode with some contemporary news reports about Camarena and about the DEA, the Mexican cartels. And sometimes they will show you the face of an anchor and as he narrates this, and then they'll kind of montage that into a different voiceover that may or may not be another anchor. And it is very confusing. It's very hard to tell like what is actual news and what is them kind of leading you into the story with their own narration, because they have a narrator who's got that sort of middle America voice.
Yeah, he does.
That is very reminiscent of an anchor. But then they also, at one point, it is even, I was like, is that Robert Stack? That guy, whoever they got, sounds exactly like Robert Stack. And then come to find out, you mentioned it really is Robert Stack.
And you're like, wait, that actually is Robert Stack? And here's the best part. He's just captioned in the Chiron says male reporter, like if you have the captions on. Like, that's no male reporter. That's my boy Stacky. Check it out.
This gun battle then raged on for over 2 hours with over 20,000 rounds expended by the narcotic traffickers. It should be noted that this was the longest gun battle in the history of the Drug Enforcement Administration. As a comparison, in the Vietnam War, American soldiers were under heavy gunfire for an average of 15 to 20 minutes before getting air or artillery support.
I have to wonder what episode of Unsolved Mysteries that came from.
I mean, it has to be Unsolved Mysteries, right? He was not a news reporter before he did Unsolved Mysteries.
No. I mean, unless there was like an Elliot Ness sci-fi flash forward, like it has to be Unsolved Mysteries, but then... I mean, was that the mystery? That, and then, like, what a cynical fucking move on the part of the government to be like, let's give it to Unsolved Mysteries so we can act like it's actually a mystery. I mean,
yeah, that's,
yeah, because there's a part of me that feels like The Last Narc. I mean, what makes this story, what sets it apart from Narcos or an episode of Gangsters about these guys or other pre-existing properties about Iran-Contra and sort of revealing what was really going on and how that was being funded. What sets this apart is this very explicit indictment that the CIA and specifically Felix Rodriguez, like, you know, Godoy says there were a lot of people who got Camarena killed, and that's true, but that the CIA, like, did him, as that guy sitting in the jail says, sadly, at the end. So this is, I mean, this is like blood stains on the hands of the U.S. government, certainly not the only ones in this sector or any other, but that is and should be really shocking and should be at the forefront. And it seems like maybe Tiller Russell was more interested in texture.
Yeah, he wants you to know these guys and like these guys and trust these guys before he dumps the thing on your head that it's the CIA. And he spends too much time on this, I think, unless he's going to really... He drops his thesis statement on us 3/4 of the way through the series. And I think every good composition class tells you, you got to drop your thesis statement up front, right?
Yeah. Don't bury the lead, especially not with this. And when this was getting some press based on the fact that it was too scandalous for the U.S. government and the national security apparatus to allow to exist, then
that feels like it's kind of up for debate. It seems like Hector Boreas is very paranoid that that someone is going to come for him.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It seems like maybe some of the kerfuffle around it not dropping when it was supposed to is him feeling like, oh, they must be on to me now.
Oh, yeah. Or pretending cynically that he thinks they're on to him now. Like, I did think there was a bit that was glossed over where it was like he retires from the DEA after, you know, he sends all this stuff about the CIA Cubano up the chain. It all gets buried. He is warned by numerous sources on various sides of the issue. Don't pursue this. You'll be Camarena'd. And then he retires. And the implication is that he was given to understand that if he didn't drop it, the Mexican warrant would be honored and he'd be sent to Mexico and tried there and he would, you know, just disappear. So now the Mexican warrant has expired and, you know, he has things on his conscience and so on and so forth. Okay, fine. But it is, like I said before, a big part of his brand, I think, to be this guy speaking truth to power who is endangering himself in order to let the truth come out. And I wonder how this would play. I wonder how this would play if it had come out this time last year. Because
that's an interesting thought.
Or into, I don't know, 2015. Like there are things that are revealed about past U.S. governments or like executive branches that like the current situation that we're in. I don't want to dismiss how serious and fucked up this is and the toll that it took on families, but. And like you ain't seen nothing, Berejes. Okay, like join us in 2020 where everything is horrible and upside down. So I do wonder how it would have played if it had come out, I don't know, January of this year.
Yeah, it's true. And we didn't all have like, you know, acres of time to binge something and stew about it either.
Yeah.
So there's that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, but it's interesting to draw the line too, from, you know, they kind of the implication toward the end is that, you know, the government does many terrible things, and this is just one of the many terrible things they did, and that it's not like one person acting; it's kind of deeply systemic, and we are kind of waking up in 2020. Many people are waking up to the idea that everything is terrible and systemic. And we needed it like in front of our faces to really have that sink in.
Yeah, I wouldn't have minded actually a little bit more time being spent on the idea, which is like mentioned in the first episode when they're talking about the importance of, you know, actually having someone who can speak Spanish go undercover with Spanish-speaking narco traffickers.
Yeah.
The U.S. government, folks. Why be a C when you can be a C-? But this, there was this idea that I think a lot of this was leveraged by the CIA, by the DEA, by people in the executive branch as... I think they could take cover behind the average American, quote unquote, not caring about brown people within the borders or on the other side.
Yeah. And especially on the other side. It's like, that's not your problem. Like these things that are happening over there, like, don't even worry about it.
Yeah. Because... Well, I think one of the most interesting parts of this story, which is why I said earlier that this could have been, you know, three episodes or 2 1-hour episodes, but it could just as easily have been 8 episodes, because I think the impossible position that so-called corrupt Mexican officials are in terms of preserving their lives and the lives of their loved ones, they had a perfect entree into that, a perfect Virgil in Godoy, who is, you know, attended by all the souls that he feels he sold out. But I think that it's probably pretty easy for the, you know, national security apparatus to not care about those gray areas and to tell the American people that they don't have to care about them either, because we're trying to keep you safe. Okay.
Yeah. And there's also this sense that I don't feel like there is any good solution presented anywhere throughout any of this.
Oh no.
It's just kind of, it drops it on your head as like, yeah, look, that sucks, doesn't it? Now you get to live with that knowledge. Bye now. And
yeah,
I don't know what they could do. Like, I'm not a foreign policy expert or a criminal justice expert or any kind of expert that would be of any use to any of this, but it sure does. It leaves a taste in your mouth that's like, oh, this kind of stuff is probably still happening all the time and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
Yeah. I don't mind that so much, though, because I was watching for this very podcast a couple of weeks ago, the Netflix series called The Business of Drugs, which up to a certain point did a very good job just explaining on a processy level, this is how the coca leaf gets to whatever, a late night bubble rave in Los Angeles. But then there was like the sort of host of that show, Amaryllis Fox. Yes, that is apparently her real name. Sort of comes on for a Sister Amaryllis Explains It All For You talking head in which like the listener or the viewer is being lectured, you know, the ethics of drug use, basically, which is like, first of all, you're not talking to me. I'm an old lady. I don't do cocaine. And second of all, even if you were talking to me, what do you want from me? Like, I felt like that was a bad choice, even though it's unsatisfying for him to be like, well, this happened and government corruption continues and hypocrisy continues around drugs. But I feel like that was more like creatively honest and less like, oh, well, now we're wrapping up a social hygiene film. I don't know.
It's a good point. I don't think anybody's going to watch anything like this and be like, oh my God, I had no idea. I'm going to stop using cocaine immediately.
Well, yeah.
The same way that you start buying recycled products.
Yeah.
I need to be socially conscious with my drug use here.
Well, really.
No more almonds. They use up water and no more cocaine because it buys into corruption.
I need to have a smaller e-cocaine footprint. I don't think that's how that works. With all of this said, I did think it was quite successful. I was not bored.
Oh, it was very compelling.
Yeah.
And I think that's down to the four main characters all being tremendous storytellers in their own right and having so many anecdotes that really, like, every bite-sized anecdote is just, like, increasingly shocking. I would say the only parts where I kind of started to glaze over, and I'm really glad, I want to be clear, I'm really glad that this is how they chose to present it, because any other way of presenting it is not something to contemplate.
No.
But anytime they showed the transcript of the torture tapes and they had the little black line that would reveal a line of dialogue and it was pretty silent in the background while you read all of this, it was a little hard to keep my interest, but also I do not want to hear those tapes. I do not want to hear those tapes reenacted. I do not want to see those tapes reenacted. And I need to know this information to continue with the story. So that was the only way to do it. It was just, it sort of slowed everything down in that moment.
Yeah, that is an excellent point there's absolutely no other way to do it. I think maybe you and I just read a little faster than some. And so it's like, okay, can you unredact the next line and then we can move on? Like, well, that's not how that works.
Make it fully interactive. Let us unredact it at our own speed.
Yes, exactly. But that's really a good point that they, in several cases, the Last Narc picks a way to convey something horribly upsetting that because it leaves a lot to your imagination, it lets it be shocking without being gratuitous, which is difficult. I will also give it credit for there is a lot of complexity and sort of, I would say, double agentry, but not really. Like, as I said before, for many of these federales or this special division of the Mexican police that was like set up by the CIA and then immediately co-opted by the narcos, which, okay, that happens every time. When are we going to learn?
Play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There is a sort of Moebius level of complexity to who is on what side at what time. And like when you're having a conversation related to you, like that sometimes it's like, wait, pause. Wait, whose side am I on? Like, and it keeps coming back to like nobody's except Kiki's and it's too late. But they do a pretty good job of creating not only momentum, but also like they untangle these complicated like secret situations and keep them pretty well untangled and at a good pace. So that's not easy. So I thought they did a good job there. Here is a snippet from episode 3 where basically they're talking about like, first of all, they're shutting down the whole Mexican border, which they never did before and have never done since, in order to try to execute a manhunt for Kiki Camarena's killers, which the United States government and the Mexican government know full well who did it. So then there's all this theater about finding a fall guy, and that is explained and sort of implied as well, quite economically, in clip 4.
When U.S. authorities ordered the crackdown, they knew chances were slim they'd find any trace of kidnapped agent Enrique Camarena.
We told the Mexican government, give us our guy back. They took their time, they obstructed, but what got the job done, and this was unprecedented and never to be repeated to this day, the Mexican border was shut down. And as that pressure grew, the Mexican government and the drug dealers had to scramble. What were you going to say? What were they going to do? Who were they going to turn over?
Yeah. And it basically, like, it wound up being one of the drug lords who then is, like, allowed to escape. I mean, the whole thing is just really bungling. But on the other hand, you saw this plot play out on The Sopranos, like, 2 different times, at least. So they do a good job with it, but there's so much there, and Godoy is this, like, such a holy fool figure, and I just wanted, like, a little bit more of some things and a little bit less of others, but I really can't wait to get into the rest of Tiller Russell's catalog that I haven't seen, because the point of view here is quite distinct and assured, I would say.
Yeah, he never doesn't know what he's trying to say. Sometimes I don't know what he's trying to say, yeah. But he always knows.
Yeah, it's true. You had one more clip. Do you want to give some context for that, or should we listen to it and then discuss?
Yeah, I'll give you a little context for that, because there's kind of two different things I wanted to get into here. And one is, you have these three guys, like we said, the ones that you're never quite sure whose side they're on. They were working for the cartels, and they were also law enforcement officers at different phases. And then in the beginning, you do not really get a grasp of who exactly they are or what their role was. They're kind of introduced via the context of, like, here's what the cartel guys needed from local law enforcement, and you don't get that these are the three guys who were directly there who then turned evidence over to Bureas. And they are really the ones that drive the story. They're the good storytellers. I mean, Godoy is one of them. And then you have this guy, Ramon Lira, who is another one of them. He's the guy with the cowboy hat and the big mustache. And he is every time he's discussed in there, you get the sense that he's like kind of over Boreas entirely. And so every time he goes back and asks him the same questions over and over, and he's like, no, I already told you that's who that is. Like, why do you keep asking me this? I already gave you the answer to that question. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, this is like 5 minutes into episode 4, and it's another thing. It's emblematic of, I feel like this is a main character of the story, and the first mention of him is basically like they kind of hint at, oh, there's another guy with a Cuban accent in the room. We don't really know who he is. And they don't even drop the punchline of who this guy is until the final episode. And it's like the CIA doesn't even really exist until that point. So those are the two things I want to point out in this clip.
All right, here's clip 5.
Boom, Angulo Ramon Lira. Who do you see that you recognize here was at Lope de Vega? Ismael Felix Rodriguez, right there, I told you about him. That's him. Identified him. I go to my people and I says, run this guy all over. And he lit up like a Christmas tree. I mean, this guy is all over the place.
Felix Rodriguez, the guy they're talking about here, he wrote an autobiography, and I immediately went to see if I could find it, because they basically, he's like the Forrest Gump of terrible foreign policy decisions.
And
he's got his hands in everything. Cuban Missile Crisis, Nicaragua, Mexican cartels. He really is all over the place.
Yeah, and that was where Amazon X-Ray really came in handy, that not only did he preside over, I guess is the term, the hunt for an assassination of Che Guevara, but stole his Rolex and brags about it still. Yeah. It's like, yes. Amazon X-Ray is like, he claims it remains in his possession. I'm like, that's bullshit. Like, we're robbing corpses now? That's fun. You seem fun. Ugh, yeah, I mean,
hit at parties.
Yeah. I know. Ask me about my Rolex. No. No thanks. Ghoul. I mean,
generally, nobody has a good story about their Rolex, but that guy especially doesn't.
No. Yeah, yikes. It's worth noting also that this, we've gotten sort of a remixed version of this comment earlier in the series, and then they just go in another direction with it. I think because this is one issue maybe with the structuring of the series, is that I think they were very attached to staying chronological. So that's why I think like the story goes fallow, and then we have to hear about them finding this Dr. Feelgood, who was brought in to like give Camarena drugs to keep him awake so he could be tortured more, and then he's like hurled out of a still moving plane onto the tarmac, and there's a lot of really horrible, disappointing stories in this. But perhaps if they hadn't gone chronologically or had skipped over, like, well, here's what became of Caro Quintero. Like, well, nothing good, I hope, right? Oh, released to house arrest? Great. But yeah, it's good. But I'm also not sure that if you are up to date on Narcos Mexico, that maybe you need this. But I recommend it anyway. It's good.
Yeah, I would recommend it as well, especially if this is something you're interested in knowing more about, which now I definitely am. I did not get all the way through Narcos Mexico, but now I'm going to have to go back and watch it with all of this extra knowledge.
Yeah. Okay. But with all that extra knowledge, who do you think the redacted source is at the very end, that they talk to that source and they've disguised this DEA guy's identity, who basically was the one who got Kiki killed explicitly? Do you have any theories?
I have no theories on that, but it was really interesting. That was almost a footnote.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, and here's another guy that we couldn't get to be one of the storytellers. It totally corroborates all of this. And it was almost, I mean, it certainly lends credibility to it, but at that point, it almost doesn't lend enough credibility to it the way they had to present it.
Yeah. I also got the feeling that they were trying to throw us off the idea that it was Jamie Kuykendall by the way that they, not sweetened, but the way they altered the source's voice.
Mm-hmm.
So listeners, if you have watched this and you have a theory about who this, I don't know, the cigarette smoking man of this horrible caper was, let us know at Blotter Presents. Well, thank you for undisappearing yourself to come and talk about this with me. I'm glad they brought it back. I'm glad that Jorge Godoy is in our lives. He is quite a documentary presence, bit like unusual for this sort of thing, and I think the project respected him. And yeah, I mean, you guys should check out The Last Narc, if only for Godoy.
Yeah, he is the undisputed MVP of the documentary, and I'm looking forward to eventually convincing Tiller Russell that he needs to release like just the entire uncut interview.
Yeah.
I feel like maybe my chief complaint about this whole thing is there was not enough Godoy.
Yeah. So you might say, I'm so sorry to do this, but you know I have to.
I know where you're going.
That you were waiting for Godoy.
Every moment he wasn't on screen, I was waiting for Godoy.
Yes. Baseball fans, I think you might also notice a sort of disconcerting but not displeasing resemblance to Mr. Esdrubal Cabrera. Let me know if I'm totally off base about that.
Oh, I see it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Before you leave us.
In local news today, bees.
Where else can listeners find you, Jessica?
Well, right now, and most times of the year, you can find me on Rob Has a Podcast covering different reality shows, and on Post-Show Recaps covering different scripted shows. We do episode recaps of various things. And right now, my two weekly jams are I am doing a rewatch of the 2000 reality series The Mole.
Yes.
It holds up, I'm telling you. It is spectacular. We're having a lot of fun with it. The podcast is called Mole Patrol, and you can find that in any of your various podcast feeds, and we're also under the rubric of reality TV Rehap Ups. And then the other show that I'm covering right now is maybe one of the greatest things that has happened to me in my podcasting life. We are covering the CBS series Tough as Nails, which is hosted by The Amazing Race's Phil Kogan. And we now, every week, the three of us that are covering this series are joined by Phil Kogan, who gives us a deep dive into the process, and he is excited about it, and his enthusiasm for what I think would otherwise be kind of an program, it's contagious. And now we're all like lifelong Tough as Nails stands. So there's that. And then occasionally I'm writing some features on primetimer.com, including one dropping this week about catfish. I've been very busy this year, which has been a blessing.
Yeah, indeed. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Epstein, art fraud, and Dog Day Afternoon. So if you don't subscribe to this podcast, why don't you go do that now so you don't miss anything? Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extra reviews and Blotter briefs, Teehee briefs, so sign up today. Today's episode was sponsored by Feels. Check the show notes for that promo code. My guests have been Kevin Flynn and Jessica Lees, and they're on Twitter at Kevin P. Flynn and Haymaker Hattie, respectively. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.